Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the October 2nd, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, it's great to be back with all of you on a beautiful Saturday afternoon here on the Space Coast. The temperature is, well, it is down a little bit. The humidity is certainly down. And I think it actually does feel like fall is in the air here on this first Saturday in October. I hope you enjoyed the UCF Knights football game last week in place of this program, despite their loss to Kansas State. The Knights are now 2-2 on the season, which I am sad to report is actually a little bit better than my own Minnesota Vikings, who, well, at least they finally won a game last week, even if it was only against the Lions. Thanks again to Space Age Technology. I watched that Vikings game on my laptop computer last Sunday in a hotel room just a few miles away from Edwards Air Force Base in California. Which, by the way, because the football games are live and the pregame show starts at 9 in the morning on the California time zone, the game start at 10. The big question was, what is football food when it's breakfast time? I mean, that's a little too early for bratwurst and sauerkraut, isn't it? I don't know. I did wind up with scrambled eggs, cheese, sausage, all doused in a healthy dose of, or maybe unhealthy, a dose of a hot sauce. So that was my football food last week. But anyway, I was in California this past week. I visited NASA's Dryden Flight Research Center at Edwards, and then later in the week popped up to San Francisco to visit NASA's Ames Research Center, which is at Moffett Field. And if you're not familiar with the area, which I wasn't until this week, just a little bit south of San Francisco, and basically kind of right in the middle, if not on a little bit on the edge of Silicon Valley there, Sunnyvale, Mountain View. I guess Mountain View is the official city closest to Ames and to Moffett Field. It's an old airfield, an old Navy airfield, in fact. I had been to Dryden before. It'd been, something like 20 years since I've been there, so there's a lot changed since then. And had never been to Ames, as I said, never even been to that part of California. But I did go out there this past week to learn more about the aeronautics research that NASA does at those two centers, and it was a rather incredible experience. You know, here on the Space Coast, I think a lot of people often forget that the first A in NASA does stand for aeronautics. And as I've learned working with the aeronautics folks over the past couple of years, you know, I mean, despite the fact that the NASA overall budget is, you know, what, 17, 18, 19 billion, depending on who you're talking to or who's promising what, you know, the NASA aeronautics budget of that share of that has only been in like the $500 to $600 million range from year to year. It's just a very small percent of the overall budget. And yet what I'm finding with these aeronautics folks is the tremendous amount of work that they're doing, the tremendous amount of neat things that they're doing. The productivity that they're getting out of their research and doing things that truly do affect and apply to all of us in our everyday lives, even though we don't see it. I mean, it is absolutely true that if you step on an airliner, if you have ever stepped foot on an airliner or maybe even in any airplane, you know, you are benefiting directly from work that NASA Aeronautics has done to help make that airplane safer, to help make its engine more efficient, more fuel efficient, less pollution, as it works its way through the air traffic control system to get you from one point to the other more safely, more smoothly, more efficiently, and constantly working to make all of those things better and better for all of us. I was at Dryden, saw a lot of neat things. The X-48B is this really cool remotely piloted vehicle, unmanned aerial vehicle, if you will. It's got a different shape to it. It's wing and it's been in the main body. It's not like a tube and a wing like you're used to seeing it. They blend all those lines together and put the engines on the top of the plane, and it's got some benefits for that: noise pollution, air pollution, the more efficient moving through the atmosphere and all that. It was neat to see both of the NASA Space Shuttle 747 carrier jets. Both happened to be at Dryden that day at the same time, and to see these two massive planes more or less sitting side by side was cool. And of course, even beyond all the science, it was just fun to see, you know, the X-1E sitting in front of the original Dryden administration building. If any of you have ever seen or watched, as I did growing up, I Dream of Jeannie, and you see that shot of, you know, Tony Nelson getting out of his convertible and running up the steps into the building with that airplane in the front. Well, that was shot at Dryden, and it looks exactly the same. I could show you the picture I took, maybe take the color out in black and white and say, hey, that's exactly what it looks like. And it was real neat to see all of that. See some of the retired jets was sad and interesting at the same time. The NASA Blackbird SR-71 sits out there now for display. One of the X-15s is out there, X-29. The F-104, just all sorts of great, famous research aircraft that NASA's flown through the years, kind of all over the place there in Lancaster and Mojave and at Edwards itself. So great visit to Edwards. Went up to San Francisco, saw all sorts of neat things. The vertical motion simulator is this great simulator they have that I kind of knew about, but I didn't really understand how it worked until I actually saw a model of it in the lobby of the building. You know, you think of this of an airplane simulator that moves, and you just kind of think of this box that sits on a bunch of pistons, and it can kind of rock back and forth and left and right and up. Well, imagine that same thing, but on a table that can twist, move left and right across, you know, several dozens of feet on a bar, and then the whole thing can move up and down, let's say 50 or 60 feet on basically an elevator like contraption. So it can move in all of these directions quite far, and, you know, you combine that with the visual cues of the TV screens around you in the cockpit, and you can get tremendously realistic effects of flying an aircraft. And what I didn't know, despite all these years that I've been covering shuttle program and been exposed to astronauts and talking about training and whatnot, I did not realize that every practical, well, I think it is every astronaut that's ever landed a shuttle has trained using a shuttle configuration in that vertical motion simulator, going back to John Young in 1981, and it's just remarkable to see that kind of involvement, again combining the aeronautics and the space and that capability that this nation has, just even in that one simulator. And it's just kind of a nondescript building sitting on a, you know, your typical college campus like environment, you know, on a field. In a building as you go by on the 101 freeway and pay it no mind, you know, and yet these incredible things are happening there as well. They've got a great air traffic control simulator where you can go up into, pretend you're in a tower of an air traffic control tower, and you're immersed in full 360-degree screens that show you, you know, they've got like 8 or 9 different airports modeled where it's just like you're really in that airport. And then, you know, we're up there and they're showing me this kind of generic desert airport. And the next thing you know, it's snowing up there. So it was just an incredible opportunity to see some of the neat things they're doing. I want to thank Karen Genvey at Ames and Greg Creech at Dryden for their hospitality and willingness to show me around. And it makes me think that although this is space talk, we should probably do an aeronautics show someday. So anyway, well, look, I've already kind of talked through the whole opening here on that, but it was just a great visit. When we come back, my guest for today's show is going to be Keith Cowing of NASA Watch fame, and he's going to be a guest for the rest of the hour, so stay tuned. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB. We'll be right back.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Our phone lines are open at 321-768-1240 for your questions and comments for our guest today or about anything having to do with the space program. And you can certainly contact us via email. The address is spacetalking@aol.com. And three questions have already popped in, and we haven't even introduced our guest yet, such as the interest today. But my guest today is well-known throughout the space community. Keith Cowing is, well, chiefly known as the creator and editor of the NASA Watch website, which, if you are not familiar with it, let's see, I tried to figure this out. It might be best described, perhaps, as the Drudge Report of the space program, maybe with a little bit of the drama and flair and sensationalism of a Geraldo Rivera thrown in. It is certainly a must-read, and Keith himself will even admit to being a kind of a polarizing figure, perhaps. Folks usually will like him or hate him or tolerate him or just be plain annoyed by him. And if someone tells you that they never bother to look at NASA Watch, they're lying through their teeth because they sure do check it daily, as I do. By the way, as I do right after I check the Viking update page, mind you, and NFL.com, we do have our priorities. But Keith is also, you need to know this, he's also a true believer of the importance of our space program to the future. He will go above and beyond the call of duty to help kids and get kids interested in math and science. He is a member of the board of directors of the Challenger Center for Space Science Education. He is an explorer at heart. He's traveled more than once to Mount Everest, and we'll certainly talk about that in a few moments. I've known Keith since before there was a NASA Watch, and certainly do consider him a colleague and fellow space cadet. And with all those words as introduction, I'm thankful that he can join us today from his home in Reston, Virginia. Keith Cowing, welcome to Space Talk, sir.
Happy to be here.
Good, good. Well, Keith, let's get right into it. We got a lot to talk about and some questions to answer. Let's first of all give us the 30-second spiel on your background and how did you wind up being involved in the space program and interested in all of this and get you to where you are today?
Well, I guess I should start where it's relevant. I was trained as a biologist, but I worked at NASA doing payload design at Space Station Freedom, and I didn't like the way that my fellow coworkers were being treated, so they were all being fired. I quit, went off to do some peer review in biomedical sciences. And then after a couple of years, the previous administrator, Dan Golden, was starting to fire people, and there was this newfangled thing called the Internet.
Yeah.
And you and I first met when with Beth Dickey and a few others down there. We dared to put our own websites up that took our own cut at how space shuttle missions were being done. And the first one I did was called the Dog Page.
Right.
Dog Crew 2. And let's just say it went uphill or downhill from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, when my friends were being laid off, I just decided that I was angry, and I created a website. The web server was in my house at the time, and with no imagination, here in Washington, if you're self-anointed, as I am, and you're tracking an issue, you usually take that issue and you add the word watch.
Yeah.
So at the time, there was a RIF, or reduction in force, being threatened, so the website was called RIF Watch. It eventually became NASA RIF Watch. And then when the RIF threat subsided, I thought, well, I can go away and I don't have to do this anymore. Not. So mm-hmm. The RIF disappeared, and that's when it became NASA Watch. And that was 16 years ago, and I've given up trying to shut it off. It's like an unwelcome guest in your spare bedroom that won't leave.
Yeah, and you stay on top of it every day and quite the following. Of course, those were pioneering days. You know, we often joke about how you were blogging long before there was a term called blogging.
Yeah, and I was then, and when Larry Wheeler from Gannett accused me of being a journalist, I guess that's the only way to put it.
Right.
I said, no, my degree's in biology. So it went, like I said, it went uphill or downhill from there.
Well, and you know, what do you think your relationship is? How is your relationship? How do you see your relationship with NASA? And can you even say it as NASA, or does it really depend on who you're talking to?
Well, you know, I mean, I do turn, I'm not a journalist 24/7, I do stuff, and just to preface this, I've always been dead honest. As a matter of fact, you're the one, as I recall, when I was first doing this, I would just write stuff, and you said, Keith, you know, you ought to say editor's note.
Yeah.
It was you, Jim, that said that you ought to, you know, parenthetically pull off what you're saying to separate it from the things that you're quoting. So it's always been either Keith, now it's Keith's note, but editor's note. And I was pretty blunt, you know, from day one that this is my opinion. I have biases. I'll list them for you. And although you compared me to Matt Drudge, I'd like to qualify that. I don't get into personal lives. It's one rule. I've never gotten into people's families. I don't do that.
Right.
But Drudge said something once that, you know, he has this reputation. This is based on the fact that he's, when he's right, he's right. When he's wrong, he makes certain everybody knows it. And that's sort of how I work it. When I've dealt with NASA, at press conferences and so forth, I consider myself a reporter, a journalist. I do, adhere to what I consider the standards of being a journalist. But when I'm not, I tell people. And sometimes you might say I sort of jump between the two. And there's now a term for it. For a while, they didn't have it. And Lou Dobbs, I guess, was personified it. You know, they say advocacy journalism.
Yeah.
You know, you're out there covering something, but you have an opinion. And so long as I feel, you know, you tell people what you are, where you're coming from, what your biases are, that isn't a confusing factor. It helps explain where you're coming from and helps you put things into a better context than just the old Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite,
sure,
or this reporter,
right,
sort of folks. So,
well, when I was a reporter at Florida Today, and I was accused of being the good cop cheerleader guy, you know, and Todd Halverson was the bad cop, you know, guy, and my bias for being pro space, you know, kept trying to get written out of the stories and whatnot, and I'd get slapped on the wrist by editors every once in a while. But you know, a guy named Chet Lunner, who worked Gannett News Service when I was starting and was somewhat of a mentor of mine, told me once that you have to cover. He said the only way he can get by it as a guy who was interested in the program is you have to treat space like you treat sports. In fact, now that I follow football, I see it directly. You know, you can be in love with the game. You can be absolutely in love with every aspect of the game, and there's nothing more cool than pro football, and I'm all for it, and I'm going to do everything I can to support it. But when the coach makes a bad call, you got to call him on it because, well, that makes the game better.
Exactly, and that's sort of, if you just scroll from the NASA Watch right now, you know, I think I would pay money to have Charlie Bolden be my neighbor. He's just the nicest, honest guy you'll ever, ever want to meet. But he's been fumbling, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, at first I sort of just tried to cover it neutrally, like, you know, if somebody of prominence said something negative, I'd cover that, and if somebody said something supportive. But, you know, as I sort of began to form an opinion here, you know, I have to say, you know, maybe people call it tough love. I don't know what phrase you'd want to use, but, you know, it's become apparent to me now that there's an issue there. And so I've sort of shifted my stance from being just a repeater of what others are saying to, you know, weighing in on it. And but yet, you know, I would like to see him succeed like I would hope every NASA administrator in the future would succeed. But, you know, there's another thing up there, just to give you an example. There's a Tom Young, who's a longtime NASA employee and advisory committee member, is speaking at NASA Langley Research Center next week about whether NASA is relevant anymore. And, hey, interesting topic. The guy's been around forever, and I would be interested to hear what he has to say. Well, I don't live in Hampton, Virginia, and I'm mm-hmm. not going to spend 2.5 hours driving down there. There's something called webcasts, mm-hmm. and you can do it with a laptop. And yet, you know, public affairs oftentimes wouldn't even think to do this. So, you know, I sort of kick him in the head there and say, you know, maybe we could find some high school student with a laptop because they're often more adept at things than, you know, public affairs is. So, yeah, you got to call the coach, and sometimes it's, you know, maybe I try not to be bleeped, but, you know, I get close to the edge sometimes in my criticism. But, you know, what else do you do? Do you just let the calls go by unmentioned? No,
right.
You don't do that.
Well, and let me ask this very specific question we got on the email. Patrick from Daytona Beach says, what does Keith think are the long-term prospects for NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden? Does he, Bolden, have the support of the president? And then ask the question, would any NASA administrator have the support of the president right now? What do you think about that?
It's quite clear that he's been in the doghouse for quite some time. They don't let him near the media. They go out of their way to keep him from being, you know, hit with questions. And when he does, he has the unfortunate tendency sometimes to go down a path that, you know, your handlers probably wouldn't want you to. Between the Marathon Oil deal, the reprimand that came from that, not only from just the White House originally, but just recently from the Inspector General and the General Counsel's Office, and the unfortunate excursion, I guess you could call it, from, you know, what he's supposed to be doing, that was in Al Jazeera. Now, going back to the Middle East, Go figure. His support at the White House is rather thin right now, and I'm not going to predict this. I wouldn't be at all surprised that after the midterm elections and after the next shuttle flight and after Thanksgiving that he decides that he's going to spend more time with his family, as they say.
Yes. Well,
and in this case, he's a family man. That would actually be 110% accurate.
Well, and he's a good soldier, and I keep trying to figure out how much of this is him being a good soldier versus how much of this is his own misfires in the public affairs arena. And
well, it's that, but I'll tell you, I mean, I don't know him that well, but I'll tell you, 20-some-odd years ago when I was working for NASA, I was down in Building 4, I think it was before they added the other addition to it, and it's a long story short, but back then when you were a government, you could mail stuff just by putting a NASA sticker on something, and I had a bunch of reports, I couldn't carry it in my luggage, I wanted to mail it back to my office up here in D.C., and I was in the office, and there was nobody there. He comes walking in, and I recognized him immediately as an astronaut.
Now, hang on there, Keith. We're going to stop you right there with that story because we're about 20 seconds away from a break. We're going to take a five-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour. Be back with more with Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. This is Jim Banky, and this is WMMB. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
If it's happening in space, Jim Banky is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Indeed, welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. 321-768-1240 is the phone number to dial into the studio. Local AT&T wireless customers, if you're driving along and want to quick make a comment or call, *1240 will get you right in. And, of course, you can send email if you're listening to us online at spacetalking@AOL.com. I remind you that during the week you can stay in touch with Space Talk via our Twitter at Space Talking or visit the WMMB webpage. Download a recording of today's show. Check out the Space Talk webpage. All sorts of things you can do right there at WMMBAM.com. Today on the show, we're joined by Keith Cowing, creator, editor of NASA Watch, all-around space guy, with us on the phone from his home in Reston, Virginia. Keith, we were talking before the break about Charlie Bolden, the NASA administrator, how long he might be lasting, and how he's a good guy. And you were talking about trying to get a hold of, was it him 20 years ago, sending him a note? Well, finish the story.
Yeah, well, I was at NASA, JSC, and I was running around, and I needed to mail something back home to my office. And I went into the secretary's office, and nobody there, and I was frustrated. And then he came in, and I recognized him as an astronaut. And, you know, I know a lot of astronauts, and let's say a lot of them wouldn't stop to help somebody with the secretarial task.
Sure.
And he helped me. He didn't know who I was. He just, you know, went and helped me find the label and so forth. And it always stuck with me that a lot of people at NASA are just so busy, especially astronauts, to just stop and help somebody you don't even know. And as such, you know, that's what people tell me he's like. So you got to ask yourself now, with all these people being laid off and his propensity for, you know, getting misty-eyed, he takes this personally. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he's there at the pleasure of the president, and he's the president's person running NASA. But, you know, when folks are being laid off, he's not being a robot about this. I do know that it affects him deeply. That said, you know, if you are going to be in a position like that where you're going to lay people off, where you're going to make difficult decisions, you know, you've got to be capable of speaking the points that you need to speak and making the decisions when they need to be made. And there's some people who now are questioning whether Charlie actually has all of that that skill set, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's so many other areas of policy here we could get into, and I'd love to get your opinion and your thoughts on it. But really, the overriding one right now, Keith, of course, is really the big one. What is going to happen? What is our space program going to look like next year after Congress gets done doing whatever it is they're doing to it? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what do the tea leaves show you in Washington where you're at up there?
Well, the tea leaves, you know, if anybody was following the drama last week, the House and Senate had different takes on where the NASA policy should be, but both of them were different than what the president had tried to launch in February, and, you know, they just botched it. They wouldn't let NASA roll it out like they did George Bush's space policy. So, you know, it was a surprise to everybody, and it was not communicated properly. And as such, a lot of what should have gone into explaining it to people, rolling it out, and showing people where it was going to go. It never happened. So it was instant food fight, and we spent this whole year pretty much going in circles with no uncertain direction evident to anybody. And even though the authorization bill was agreed to last week and the president is likely to sign it very soon, there's still the issue of the budget that will go with it and the fact that NASA is operating under a continuing resolution. So it's sort of like, you have part of the answer, you don't have the full answer, and we're not probably going to know much until the election is over. If the Democrats retain leadership in the House and the Senate, I think you'll see more of the same. If, for example, the Senate were to flip, Senator Shelby, who's been in the minority, will suddenly have a much larger role and voice in things, and you may see some significant changes.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the shuttle is being retired. That decision was made in 2004, and it's been endorsed by Democrats and Republicans, several Congresses and two administrations. And, the shuttle is going away. There's apparently going to be an additional flight, but then the issue is, what's next? Well, Ares 1 seems to have evaporated from everybody's plans. Ares 5 may come back as something other than Ares 5 with a different name. I mean, I worked on Space Station Freedom, and then that program was technically canceled, and then we built the International Space Station. But if you go look at it, it's like Freedom with the Russian stuff stuck on it. So
Yeah. Sometimes
the name isn't necessarily, all there is.
Right.
But you will likely see a heavy launch vehicle. The question is whether it'll look something like Ares 5, or, as is still being discussed, and the Space Coast folks should be interested in this, is there more than one heavy launch vehicle? I mean, what is it NASA needs to launch? We still don't know what is going to be put in there. And it's kind of like going to rent a truck to move. I'm not going to tell you how big the house is. So what do? Do you rent the biggest truck? Do you rent a little truck? Do you rent two little trucks? That's a bit of the problem. And you may see that one of the solutions that comes out of this is going back to heavy versions of the Atlas and Delta and the Falcon. So that's still a TBD, and I don't think we're really going to get a lot of clarity on this until certainly after the election, but most likely next February when the next budget comes out. It's a lot of hurry up and wait.
Let me ask you this question related to all that, and it's interesting, Keith, because it shows you and I think our listeners the kind of relationship that the readers have with you and with NASA Watch because of the way the question's asked. Let me just read it to you verbatim, and I don't have a name with this, which is interesting, but I do know it comes from somebody who works in the solid rocket booster world, and here's the question to you, Keith. He meaning you, often complains about Congress being too prescriptive on the design of an HLV, a heavy lift launch vehicle. Doesn't he know that members say they are because they learned a lesson from NASA this year, and that is if they don't get specific, NASA just ignores them, meaning Congress. Plus, Congress directed it because they don't want to wait to leave low Earth orbit until 2025 or 2030. Is Keith Cowing against leaving low Earth orbit as soon as possible?
No, and this is typical of the readers. They just get hysterical, and they say because this and that, therefore, Keith doesn't want to leave low Earth orbit. They haven't apparently been reading NASA Watch very long. I'm a staunch advocate. I've written articles like, why do we keep going in circles? Why are we stuck here? I've been complaining about this since I've been complaining.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, Congress being prescriptive, what they should do is say, here are the places that NASA should go. Here's the rough capability that we are supporting. But it's kind of like going back and just saying, and you're going to use a 1965 Ford Fairlane, and you're going to strap something on there. It's like saying, just take something that is not state of the art, and because we're concerned that people will be laid off in Utah. Rather, what they ought to say is, go use whatever smarts you have, let the private sector provide this stuff, and instead of getting one rocket, which we've learned is the big mistake NASA's made oftentimes, is that they put all their eggs in one basket, whether it's the X-33, the X-34, Venture Star, all these things, and then when that thing becomes a problem, it becomes too big to fail, you start throwing a lot of money into it, then you realize it won't work, and you're stuck with nothing. Why not come up with a system where you say, we want to go beyond Earth orbit to the moon, Mars, asteroids, wherever, rough approximation of the throw weight, and say, you're going to come back with a robust system that is tolerant such that if one capability doesn't materialize, another one can.
Yeah, and
it's a fly-off oftentimes, and it's the military uses it, and although the military isn't often the best example,
right.
Oftentimes you do see that they have more than one jet, and if one doesn't work out, they've got another one that's being developed at the same time. It's a little more expensive up front, but you end up oftentimes saving a lot of money down the road. So they're right that if you don't tell NASA specifically what to do, NASA will go off and do whatever they want. They're absolutely right.
Well, and let me add to it that, and I've said this often on this program, you know, my view on all this is that I wish we would think more in terms of capability, that we want the ability to put a large piece of cargo into orbit. We need the ability to bring it back. We need to be able to put people in orbit and bring them back. We need to be able to move things from one orbit to another. We need to be able to move things from this planet to the moon and to beyond and back. And I think we should be developing that infrastructure and capability and not do it necessarily to design to a specific mission. I don't need to design a very specific mission to a specific rocket, and then you're stuck with what you have. Let's build a capability and then go back to the community and say, okay, we got a rocket that can lift this. Now tell us what, you know, go build your mission according to this way. But that doesn't work with politics. It doesn't work with lobbyists. It doesn't work with voters and
when. Oh yeah, I wasn't born, you know, like I said, I wasn't born yesterday, and I understand the senator from ATK, you know, was all pleased about the fact that he had completely tweaked America's space program to preserve 600 jobs. You know what? If he was really that concerned, there'd probably be more efficient ways to save the 600 jobs than to send America's space program off on a point design.
Yeah.
The reason why they're solid rockets to begin with is the shuttle was originally supposed to be a completely reusable system. As you know, there was a flyback booster concept, and they went to Nixon, and Nixon said, well, you know, it was actually Kent Weinberger, head of OMB,
right.
Said, well, you can have one or the other. You can have the reusable shuttle or the reusable flyback, but you can't have both. So they went with a shuttle, and the only way to, you know, get the up mass that you can, you know, use without using a Saturn V first stage is to use solid rocket boosters. So it was a political compromise that put us in that place to begin with.
And
so was that the best design? I don't think it was, but it was designed that politics forced upon us. And for those members of Congress who scream and holler about, you know, oh, well, Congress is designing rockets, well, yeah, and they got a lot of experience at designing them.
and not necessarily to our benefit, and of course,
no,
you know,
not at all.
That is ultimately the key issue is and you got to figure out a way to explain it to these guys and get the support you need, and it's just so tough that we're stuck into these compromises, and you know, hopefully this is why I have such strong hopes for the commercial community, that they can see the light, that they can, and we're getting hints of that now, that they can. That they know what we need is this first space program. They go develop this stuff. I'm tremendously impressed with SpaceX and continue to wish them the best and hope and keep our fingers crossed on that. Keith, we're going to take our final break, and when we come back, we're going to very quickly get to the two other big things I really want to talk to you about, which is the Challenger Center and your experience at Mount Everest. So stand by for that, and we're going to take our final break here on Space Talk. And be back with some moments here with Keith. This is Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Well, and welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. My guest for these final few moments again, Keith Cowing from NASA Watch. And Keith, you know, I want people to make sure that they understand that you give as good as you get, and the grief you get, and you give it right back in a positive way. You are very much involved with the Challenger Center, and I would like you to just spend a couple of minutes and talk about that fine organization and what it's all about.
Well, the Challenger Center was founded by the Challenger Center for Space Science Education was founded by the families of the crew of Challenger, led mostly by June Scobie Rogers, a steel magnolia of great capability. And they created this organization just under 25 years ago, and it has now resulted in 50 learning centers across the United States. The Challenger Center was doing STEM before STEM was called STEM.
Yeah.
And we recently took the board and reconfigured it, added a lot of new people, myself included, under the leadership of Bill Reedy, who is the one who pulled me off the street one day and says, you're going to be on the board. And we've tried to retool it to make it 21st century compliant, to really try and get a lot of the current technologies and so forth in there, and to expand beyond the traditional fourth to sixth grade subset of the population to go pretty much down to kindergarten all the way up to grandma and grandpa. The idea being that, you know, space is a wonderful metaphor and a place where you can, you know, be excited about something. As the old adage says, you know, if you don't learn your algebra, you won't be a rocket scientist. Well, you know, trying to give them experiences that, you know, it's not just the kids doing the math and science, but, you know, what about the football player? You know, what about the dancer? I mean, there are other ways to you know, have a career in space that don't necessarily, you know, focus on STEM, but, you know, you got to find a way to engage the kids and make them feel like they're part of this. And apparently it works because these kids go out of there and so many of them have gone on to have careers, not necessarily just in NASA, but elsewhere. But they were inspired by the whole experience.
It is the spirit of exploration, the spirit to learn, the spirit to apply that sense of wonder to whatever the topic is at hand. I mean, I'm sure that's all part of it. And certainly in terms of the spirit of exploration, you have become somewhat of an explorer yourself, and talk about your experiences.
My business partner and I have been to Devon Island up in the Canadian Arctic, 800 miles from the North Pole, 3 times. We donated a greenhouse, one we would hope would be a prototype for how you do things on Mars. So to the previous caller's question about me interested in going beyond low Earth orbit, you could say that. And I've also been out to NASA Desert Rat several times. But, you know, I guess the most enjoyable experience was I've only been to Everest actually once. I was supposed to go in 2008 with Scott Peresinski when he made his first attempt. But because China was manipulating Nepalese politics and they were not allowing any reporters in, I would most certainly have been arrested and expelled from the country had I gone.
You made it as far as Nepal but not up to the mountain. Is that right?
No. Actually, I only went in 2009. I didn't even go in 2008.
Oh, okay.
Full the trip. But in 2009, my friend Scott, who talk about this the right stuff. He's the iconic casting. And I've known Scott for 25 years. I knew him before he was an astronaut. We were both young, but, you know, he's an MD, I'm a biologist. And it's a long story short, but our friend Miles O'Brien was in on this too. He was supposed to have gone with us, but he had a production that he couldn't get out of. So it ended up that Scott went into Nepal. I followed him later, and I worked at base camp sort of as his new Sherpa as he made his way to the summit. Miles was sort of our producer back in New York City, and we had with us an Apollo 11 moon rock that Scott carried to the summit, and he brought that back with a piece of Everest, and now both of those rocks are in orbit around the Earth, the International Space Station, and I'm expecting to hear that Administrator Bolden will reference this accomplishment within the next 24 hours, because he's in Kathmandu, Nepal, right, or he will be very soon.
Okay.
What we tried to do, and if you look at the picture of Scott, I mean, he's sitting there standing on the summit with the Challenger patch on his jacket and holding up that moon rock. We were hoping that between that and other things such as Richard Garriott, who's also on our board, we had the Challenger logo in orbit, that we show kids that, you know, we're a board of not just a bunch of, you know, old guys who sit there, but we go out and we put our money and our, you know, sometimes actually risk our lives to show what it is like to explore and then to explain to folks back home what it takes to get here and that it you too can do this.
That's just absolutely incredible. And with about 30 seconds left with you, Keith, you know, you came back, and I don't know, maybe you're still processing how that affected you and what you learned from that whole experience.
Scott and I joke, we think about it every day. You've been back for both. And he went to the summit. The highest I got was base camp. I lived there for a month at 17,500 feet. But it was like being on another planet. It changed. It is the most austere place you ever want to go, and it changes you. And I hope I think about it every day for the rest of my life.
And that's outstanding. Keith, we got to wrap up here with some business, so we want to say goodbye to you right now. Thanks for being on Space Talk, and you've been a great supporter. And we'll continue to work together and do our own thing and together try to make this space program better for everybody.
As always, Ad Astra, Jim.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, there goes Keith Cowing, editor of NASA Watch. And, again, love him or hate him, he is there, and he's part of the thing, absolutely a force to be reckoned with. So, hey, look, as well, we're going to wrap up here. I want to remind you that our next planned launch from the Cape now appears to be Shuttle Discovery from the Kennedy Space Center. Discovery is targeted to fly at about 4:40 p.m. Eastern Time. On November 1st, it'll be making its final trip into space, as well as its final trip to the International Space Station. I should mention, by the way, that the space station now has 3 crew members aboard, in case you were wondering. having said goodbye to three others who returned to Earth safely this past week. And now this upcoming week, on this Thursday at about 7:10 p.m. Eastern Time, another three crew members will launch to the station from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. If you happen to get NASA Watch, you should be able to NASA Watch. Listen to me. If you happen to get NASA TV, you can watch it on NASA Watch, too. Watch NASA TV in your home there. You should be able to see some coverage from NASA on that. Back home here, first week of November, again, Discovery on the 1st. It looks like the Delta IV may fly or try to get squeezed in on the Eastern Range on November 4th, followed by the Falcon 9, the second Falcon 9 flight from SpaceX. They're still on the range for November 8th. So we're going to just have to keep an eye on all of that and see how it plays out. In any case, Discovery, Delta IV, Falcon 9 are the only three remaining rockets on the range that we expect to fly through the end of this calendar year. So, again, we'll keep an eye for you and keep you up to date. And, of course, we'll have live launch coverage here on WMMB whenever all of those launches take place. Let's see. Looking next week here on Space Talk, my guest is going to be Derek Weber. He is the author of a brand new book coming out this month entitled The Right Stuff, spelled W-R-G-H-T. The book is about space tourism, reviews some history about the idea of tourists going to space, some work done by the general public to harness the power of rocketry for various modes of transportation. And it's a very interesting book. Again, it's just now coming out onto the shelves. We have a preview copy we're taking a look at now. We'll talk to Derek next week about it, so I certainly do hope that you will tune in. Well, I guess that's it for today. The Vikings have a bye week, so we get tomorrow off. Going to put our feet up and enjoy the rest of the weekend. Thanks again to all of you for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mylos Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. The Home Mortgage Law Show is next here on WMMB. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.